Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, April 26th. We have three items on our agenda. Before we start, let's do a roll call.
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Present by telephone, but will soon be by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke is excused.
And Madam I'd Chair. Like to mention that Representative Reschke will be joining us shortly for anyone listening and wondering.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. Thank you. Of the three items on our agenda, I'm going to do them in a different order than they were published. I'll let you know what it's going to be. We're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2972. And depending on the timing, we may go next to the public hearing. And then we will finish up with a work session on House Bill 3143. That's the order that I'm anticipating right now. I'm opening the work session on House Bill 2972.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Chris Alanek, Legislative Revenue. House Bill 2972, you had a public hearing on March 23rd. It would require LRO to study land value taxation and submit a report to an interim committee. And it defines land value taxation as a property tax system with a higher rate of tax on land than improvements. You had some testimony. You had some advocates for it. It was presented to you by Rep. Nose. And during the discussion, it was basically the general nature of a land tax, how that works and how different it is from the current system. There were discussions of a goal of revenue neutrality. So it wouldn't, the design wouldn't necessarily be to increase or decrease property taxes, but to keep revenue system, to keep the revenue system neutral. One of the reasons the advocates were lobbying for it is that it might address some of the current inequities that exist in our Measure 5, Measure 50 system. Having said that, there are a number of questions. One area of questions were how urban areas would be treated differently or similar to rural areas. And we have gotten a couple of questions since the public hearing. One of those questions was, how long has this been around? To my knowledge, it was first presented, I think, in the late 1800s by Henry George. So it's been around since the latter half of the 19th century, at least in concept. And in terms of use, I think a few states dabbled with it. But to my understanding, currently, the only states that come close, the only state that comes close is Pennsylvania. And there are some cities that use it. And it is this split roll kind of concept where the tax rate on land is higher than the tax rate on improvements. So it's not a pure land value tax system. A pure system would be no tax on improvements, and the only tax would be on the land, in part because land is fixed. So it can be what an economist refer to as an efficient tax. And by not taxing improvements, it encourages kind of condensed use and highest productivity of the land, like in the city centers, for example. So I can stop there to see if there are any other questions. Otherwise, I can probably ramble on.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, if I can remember them both. It sounds like a land tax is not in effect at this moment any place in rural America. You said a couple of cities are using it, but you didn't describe any rural areas. And the second question is, I'm wondering when property has been destroyed, then if a tax that is entirely placed on land, when structures have been destroyed, still stays static. I just wonder if you have any knowledge of that.
Well, I think part of it, your first part, it is, I think, a couple dozen, 20 to 25 cities in Pennsylvania use some form of it. So I'm not aware that it is used in any rural areas. So I think so far it is just at the city level. And in terms of property being destroyed, I think, we got into this a little bit last time, one of the key features of this, just mechanically, and I should say part of the reason for this study is to really delve into these questions. Since it's not widely used, we don't necessarily have a lot of information on it, although there are reports out there about it. And I did include in OLIS a report that was referenced last time on a simulation run by NERC. But in terms of the damaged property, I would think that the value of the land would need to be reassessed on an annual basis. So, because the idea is to tax the value of the land, and you would need an annual reappraisal of that land. And depending on the damage to it, that could affect that value. I mean, it depends on a lot of factors that go into it. But if property and all of the improvements are destroyed, then I guess on the upside for the local governments, there's not a loss in property tax revenue at that point. But depending on the nature of the damage, it could affect the value of the land. And I don't know if it would really operate on kind of a levy system where you figure out the value of the land, and then you approach it from the budget side, and then determine the tax rates, kind of like the system that we had prior to Measure 5.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I don't see, Rep. Pham, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, could you talk a little bit about what it would take for LRO to do this study? Like, just how much time, or just the scope of work that you would see, or just the options for the scope of work? Because I know that you have to fit it within your other existing responsibilities. Like, what is the fiscal impact that we're thinking about?
That's a good question, Rep. Pham. So if the bill were to pass, I mean, we would need some detailed discussions with the committee and make sure it's lined up with expectations, because one route would be to not put a fiscal on it and have that work done within LRO only, within existing staff, and fit it in with our workload. That would put some pressure on us in terms of our availability to do a fully detailed study, but we could move the ball down the field, so to speak, in terms of addressing any legal questions, getting a better handle on some of the issues and the questions. But it would need to fit within our regular legislative calendar, which gets kind of cramped because of sessions, and the session work always takes priority. To that end, it wouldn't have to be in statute. It could be part of an interim work plan. Another option would be to actually put some money to this. I don't know exactly, I'd have to think about exactly how much money it would cost, but hire a private sector consulting firm to do a much more detailed and potentially robust analysis, where they can dedicate all of their resources for, say, a full year or several months to the project.
Thank you.
And I will add another couple of questions for you. And again, we don't have to discuss this in depth, because the point is to have a study to better understand it. But given some of your description of this approach, a land value tax, or shifting toward a land value tax, could you describe are there two options, results of this that are maybe linked but not dependent on each other? This could be used to encourage density, or it could be used to just encourage continued development, like investment in certain areas. But density and investment generally aren't necessarily related. It depends on the zoning laws in place.
Yes, Madam Chair, the zoning regulations and all of the requirements that go along with improvements, capital investment, come into play here. But what it does take off the table is the taxation of investing in a new manufacturing plant or any other kind of improvement on the in a given area. So we know that taxes affect some of those decisions, and by focusing on the land, that a lot of the value of the land is inherent in the public investments. And I'm again thinking of cities here, where you have a lot of the local amenities within a city really adds and creates value to the land within the city. And by taxing that, you have basically have a situation where you have public investment creates private benefit, and it's really capturing that tax, which is at the heart of this. And
So that raises another couple points for me. This I can see this instigating zoning battles and zoning conflicts because value is linked to zoning. We hear about upzoning all the time. We hear it discussed because of density, but in this case, it would be a real hot topic because it's going to relate directly, I believe, to taxation. Another thing that it makes me wonder is we've had some struggles in the past over the taxation of real property because in some cases, there are certain types of equipment that are included as real property, not personal property. How does that factor into, if we shifted to a land tax, does that take away those discussions about real versus personal property? And then does all of that real property that is not land become personal property?
I think it does affect it, at least as my thinking now. And this is, a lot of this is somewhat premature without fully studying it, but my thoughts so far is that it changes the nature of the question. So it makes this real versus personal not part of the equation because what is taxed is the land. And all of the difficulty that the county assessors have and the variances that we have across counties on the issue that you're referring to, in my mind, the way I'm thinking about it, those would go away. It's really just the land. Now, you mentioned the zoning. I could see some complications there. I'm also not sure about urban growth boundaries. I don't know that the Pennsylvania, I'm not sure about Pennsylvania's land use laws, but I don't think they have UGBs. I mean, Oregon seems to be somewhat unique in that. Maybe not unique, but so that's another factor that would come into play in terms of really studying how this might work in Oregon. And even the purity of the land value tax, if that's ultimately the goal, there are questions about, does it raise enough revenue? Some of the literature I've read suggests that areas that have studied it are concerned about whether or not it's adequate. It might resolve some of the equity issues, but does it create adequacy issues? And those are the kinds of things we'd really want to get a handle on before you move forward with it. And I think the advocates last at the public hearing even mentioned that there would be a transition period that could be 5-10 years where there would be a long time period just because there'd be a lot riding at stake. And all of this, of course, has to go through the state's constitution.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair. So, Chris, how would you see this affecting, like, where I live, where significant farm ground and the value of ground that is producing food that feeds Oregon, basically feeds everybody. And so we're considered to have what's called high value ag ground. How would you see this affecting that?
That's a good question, Rep. Levy, and that would be, I would argue that would be one of the key pieces in such a study. Again, I think most of this in terms of an urban setting, where a lot of the amenities of a city access, you know, utilities, roads, sidewalks, sewer system, all of this public investment creates a lot of value. And under privately owned land, you have public investment transferring value to the private sector. I'm not sure exactly. I don't know, you might know better than I do, how much public investment is there in farmland or rangeland that might be an analogy. I don't think there is, but I don't know at this point.
It's usually not public investment. Yeah.
So I think that would be one of the questions. The land has that value for those purposes. And I don't know if that plays into the adequacy issue. But again, these would be all questions that there might be some answers in some of the work that's out there. This is an issue that has come and gone in terms of interest levels over the years.
Mr. Alanak, following up on that, I know it would add a lot of complexity, but one thing I would be interested to see a study contemplate is a dual system or a hybrid where maybe this would apply to land only within incorporated cities or within UGBs in Oregon's situation. That's one way to do it. Or another way is, could there be such a tax system based on a land use designation? For example, it would be based only on residential, industrial, and commercial, or only on residential, or only on commercial, or something like that. But I assume that all those sorts of things could be studied about whether it's feasible or too complicated to apply or even legal.
Yes, Madam Chair. And the way I think about it, it's more the issue of property tax reform, and land value tax could be a piece of that issue, as opposed to studying land value tax and going down a path that do we do land value tax or not? Because the better question may be reform of the overall system, and how does a land value tax fit into that? And in some ways, that's kind of a split role tax. I've heard some stakeholders refer to the split role. More often than not, though, when I hear split role, I think of residential property taxed one way and commercial and an industrial taxed another way, which is a different way to slice and dice the property. So an argument could be made that the land value tax, rather than studying just that, would be within the overall system to get at some of the issues that you discussed.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. It's like one of the fundamental conundrums that we face always in the property tax is how to incorporate in the value of increasing property prices. You know, here in Oregon, we've chosen to do that just by using an assessed value. So essentially, we never accommodate real market values. In California, there's a resetting of the property value when property is sold. But it continues to be, it's just a real conundrum because we have people who have made purchases or investments in land predicated on a certain expectation of property taxes. And if we incorporate in the growing real market value, then all of a sudden they can be faced with very different kinds of bills than they started off with. So is there anything in the land approach that inherently that addresses that, or is that just an albatross that we still drag with us and have to resolve?
I think I have a lot of questions on that front myself. The way I think about it is that it has to be the real market value of the land. The true cash value, the true value, the real market value, not an artificial value like assessed value that we have in our current system, which is based on some calculation, so it's not completely made up, but it's the real market value, and letting the market determine the value of that land, say, if we're talking just within city limits. And then whatever those fluctuations are in the market could be a situation for the adequacy question. So if we look at the property tax value, property value in Oregon, you know, you see the assessed value growing up at 3%. That's by design, but you can also see the real market value going up and down along with the market. So that would be a concern long-term for local governments within this kind of system. So that's something else we'd want to dive into in a lot of detail.
Thank you. Committee, this has been a really interesting conversation to explore what the topic might include. Rep. Reschke has a question, and then after this, I'd like to move to our public hearing. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I jumped in a little bit late, and I'm assuming we're on House Bill 2972. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're just exploring the idea today.
I just had a couple of questions for LRO, if I might.
Sure.
One thing is, this seems to use a particular methodology to come up with property tax values. And I'm just wondering how long this method has been out there or available. Is it something relatively new, or has it been around for a long time?
Rep. Reschke, I would go with the long time.
Okay.
I first learned about it in conjunction with a person named Henry George. And he wrote a book about it in the late 1800s. I want to say 1879, something like that.
You weren't classmates, were you? No, no?
That's confidential.
Very good. Okay, so it's been around a while. And then I guess my follow-up question would be then, do other states or use this method to assess property values today?
To my understanding, it's used in a handful of cities in Pennsylvania today.
Okay.
So not at a state level, and just within these cities in Pennsylvania, maybe 25 cities. And I don't believe it's a pure land value tax. I believe they have a split roll where they have one rate for land and a different rate for improvements.
Ah, okay. All right. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Alanek.
Sure. And Rep. Reschke, we've had a really interesting discussion. I don't know exactly when you joined us, but you might want to listen to the earliest part of the meeting. Representatives Pham and Levy and Marsh raised interesting points.
I will go back and listen. Thank you.
Any last thing before we get to our public hearing now? Okay, I'm closing this work session on House Bill 2972. I'm opening a public hearing now on House Bill 2462.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Caitlin Harger from the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2462 requires that contracts between pharmacies and pharmacy benefit managers be amended to reflect or to refund costs associated with any increase in a pharmacy's costs above 0.3% of the costs related to new fees or taxes that are in place. It prohibits retaliation by the pharmacy benefit managers, the PBMs, within statute. And it requires insurers offering health insurance in Oregon to submit their contracts with PBMs to DCBS for review. There are four amendments that are posted in OLIS. The first one, the dash one, removes from the bill the requirement that the PBMs adjust contracts due to changes in fees, which effectively means that only changes in taxes would be addressed by this legislation. The dash two does that, and then it removes the reporting requirement for insurers to DCBS. The dash three adds to the statute, or adds to the bill, a definition of new tax as being defined as a tax applicable to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2020. And then dash four combines those three amendments.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for Ms. Harger before we move to the witnesses for today? I see a hand raised. Actually, Representative Smith.
You know, actually, Madam Chair, I think I better hold my questions. I have three of them, but let me hold them until I hear a little more testimony, so maybe my questions will be answered by folks who are going to speak. So I apologize.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. We'll move now to the list of people who have signed up to testify. There are seven people who have signed up, and in the past, we have requested that in public testimony, you keep your comments to around 3 minutes each. We hope that that will be satisfactory to get your points across. We invite you to submit written testimony anytime up to 24 hours after the hearing started today. So anytime up until 3:15 tomorrow, please feel free to submit your written testimony. And as we call on you, remember to turn on your camera and your mic. I will let you know the order that I'm calling on people so you can start to get ready. It will be Ann Murray, followed by Jack Holt, then Bill Head, followed by Vince Porter, then Adrian Irwin, Regina Mendez-Harper, and Nikki Terzia. Okay, we'll start with Ann Murray.
Hello, and thank you, Chair Nathanson and committee members. My name is Ann Murray, and my husband John and I own Murray Drug, located we serve Morrow, Gillam, and Wheeler counties since 1959. Our service area includes over 3,000 square miles in rural Oregon as the only pharmacy provider. We employ 25 employees between full and part-time throughout our three stores. All three of our stores have been and are currently giving COVID vaccinations. Like grocery stores, pharmacy is a very low-margin business where we cannot control our reimbursement. 95% of our patients have their medications paid for by a third party whose contracts dictate what they will pay for a given item. This can be less than the cost that we paid for them. Other than raising a cash price to the small percentage of uninsured patients, which we refuse to do, we are not able to pass through the expense of the CAT tax. Even if we were able to raise prices by this amount, it would only reflect an increased gross sales, thus increasing the CAT tax. Gross sales do not reflect profitability. Both food and medicine need to be exempted for access to these to be protected. We appreciate that this bill's attempt to alleviate the financial impact on pharmacies in our state. During COVID, people saw the importance of having pharmacies in our communities. From medication to information and now COVID vaccinations, we are an important partner in keeping Oregonians healthy and surviving this pandemic. Each day in our pharmacy order, we receive about $3,000 to $5,000 worth of medications in just one tote at one of our stores. This equates to about $100,000 per month in just the cost of the medications. Therefore, taxing businesses that do over $1 million in gross sales does not only affect large corporations, but also our small pharmacies that do 100 to 200 prescriptions per day. Cash flow is a constant challenge. In our stores in rural Oregon, cash flow is a constant challenge due to low margins. Our first CAT tax bill we just paid in April was $23,000. If pharmacies have to borrow money to pay this tax, they won't last long. This amount is the estimated cost of a badly needed new roof for our store in Condon. Because we sell expensive items for which we have no control over the cost of the medication from the manufacturer or the retail price set by the PBMs, we are left with an extremely low margin. The gross CAT tax when applied to pharmacies, threatens an already fragile healthcare system in rural areas. The best way to help us would be to exempt prescriptions from the CAT, but this bill offers the next best solution. Thank you for giving this bill a hearing and letting us discuss the threat this CAT tax is to our future viability. It will greatly impact access to medication and pharmacy services in Oregon communities, especially rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and please stay with us. I see that there's a question or comment. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Anne, I have a couple questions for you, if it's okay. First, I just want to make sure folks on the committee understand something I think you heard or something you stated, and that is our small local pharmacies have no control over the price that they pay to the manufacturers or control the price of the PBMs. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes.
So then I guess this is where I'd ask my urban legislators to work with us rural folks. I think about some of the legislation I helped pass today to benefit what I would consider the more urban areas. And I'm going to ask a question. And Ben, of your small little pharmacies in Condon, Hefner, Boardman, what percentage of your, and if this kicks into your business plan, feel free not to answer it, but what percentage of your sales are pharmaceutical versus, you know, the front store items of the nice little cookie jar and those type of things? What percentage?
So for us, I would say 80% is prescriptions, 20% is the other things that we carry. We've tried to diversify. We opened a flower shop, which was really decimated during COVID, no funerals, no weddings. So 80%, I would say. And that's what makes us different from the chains, is because they have a bigger out front where they can have a bigger margin where they can control their retail price. But we can't control the price that we receive for the prescriptions. And like I said, 95% of the time.
So, Madam Chair, follow up.
Okay.
And so if the CAT tax that's been brought forward was to put a pharmacy or rural pharmacy out of business, let's just say your pharmacy, how far would somebody in Condon have to drive to go get their meds? How far would somebody from Hefner have to drive to go get their meds?
In Condon, it's an hour and a half one way to the Dalles. We also have a lot of patients in Wheeler County. They don't have a pharmacy. They would have to go to Redmond or Madras. That would be at least an hour and a half to 2 hours. In Hefner, we're about an hour from Hermiston. Boardman is 30 minutes to Hermiston, I guess.
So, Madam Chair, I know we don't want to do a lot of carve outs on the CAT tax. I know we've tried to let the CAT tax kind of mature and simmer, if you will. I would just ask all of us, though, to recognize that there are a few key players that are instrumental to the health and safety of Oregonians that we may want to take a little bit deeper look at and see if there really is a way, to exclude them from a method of taxation that really does harm our most vulnerable Oregonians. So Chair Nathanson, I know you're a great leader, and so I just wanted to share that message. Thank you.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Anne, very much for coming and testifying. I really have to echo exactly what Rep. Smith said, because in my community, we have Hermiston Drug. And just this year alone, they lost over $68,000 because of the taxes that, or the way that they're formed, and because of the overlying part. And then they have almost a $10,000 tax on top of that for the CAT tax. And if you're losing money, you can't come up with money to pay the CAT tax. So I understand everything that you're saying, Anne, and I would hope that we would figure out a way to help our rural pharmacies, because I know that they're all struggling.
Thank you.
Thank you both. And of course, this bill would help those community pharmacies. Our next speaker, thank you, Ms. Murray. Our next speaker is Jack Holt.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, and the members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. My name is Jack Holt, and I'm here on behalf of independent pharmacies and small regional chains. I'm currently the executive officer of a six-store group of pharmacies known as Pillbox Drugs. We operate stores in Deschutes, Polk, Marion, Benton, and Linn counties. At the height of our business, Pillbox Drugs operated 10 stores in Oregon, but four stores which were located in Baker, Lincoln, and Deschutes County were sold for various reasons, mostly economic. Our current locations are small pharmacies, which generate more than 95% of our sales only from prescription drugs. Unfortunately, over the years, it has become more difficult to operate pharmacies profitably due to the extremely thin profit margins on prescription pharmaceuticals. These pharmacies are essential participants in the communities in which they operate. Many people are dependent upon the medications dispensed, the counseling they receive, and the relationships developed with their local pharmacist. In 2020, last year, our six locations generated a little over $18 million in total sales. It employed more than 40 people. While this may sound like a winning combination, when one looks at the net profits for the year, it generated a loss of over $89,000, of which more than $93,000 was attributed to cat tax. We would have been profitable last year if it was not for the tax that we had to pay. In other words, these stores would have been marginally profitable, but they were not. As a consequence of our last year's financial report, I have started discussions with an interested party for one of our locations. And as a company, we are considering the sale of another of our locations in 2022 if economic conditions do not improve soon. We just cannot survive at a loss. I ask for your support in passing House Bill 2462 this session. It provides much needed relief for pharmacists so that they can remain viable and serve the people in their communities. I want to thank you for your consideration of this request.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. And for any of you testifying, if you're able, please stay with us in case there's a question that comes up later. Otherwise, you can just hang back in the room while we call on the other people. Next is Bill Head.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Bill Head on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, PCMA, with the National Trade Association for PBMs. Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to testify on HB 2462. I speak in opposition to the bill based on a number of policy and practical concerns we have with the bill has proposed. Starting with Section 2, Subparagraph 2 states, if a pharmacy, including a pharmacy that contracts with a PBM, this means all pharmacies. So even pharmacies that PBMs do not have any relationship with, a PBM or PBMs would be responsible for their CAD tax or their tax, rather, that increases by 0.3%. So it's beyond just contracted pharmacies. Also, it states, even with the Dash 4 amendment, states that if the pharmacy becomes subject to, quote, a new tax that increases, that exceeds their drug sales by 0.3%. So this would mean any state tax, not just the CAD tax, any county tax, any local tax. So very broad, it's a very broad application. It also, if we're talking about rural pharmacies and some of the testimony, which we are very sensitive and concerned about as well, but this bill would certainly advantage the larger urban pharmacies over the independents. Larger urban pharmacies are able to absorb these tax increases through the sale of items other than pharmaceuticals. However, they would get the benefit of this legislation. Finally, from a practical matter, how do we actually implement this? if because pharmacies have more than one contract with one PBM, let's say, for example, they have they contract with four PBMs, just by way of example, and the tax, whether it's state, county, or local, that tax increase exceeds their pharmaceutical sales by the 0.3%, and let's say that results in an excess of $100. Do each of those four PBMs pay that $100? So not only is that pharmacy being made whole by the $100 increase, but they're collecting an additional $300 from the PBMs. So they're actually profiting from the bill. I don't think that's certainly the intent, and I don't think the pharmacies are looking to do that, but that is the practical application of the legislation. And finally, how does the PBM reconcile how this actually works? Can the PBM request an audit to see that the 0.3% threshold has been met? Because they won't be able to determine this by themselves, because that's just one pharmacy contract. PBMs don't have insight into the other contracts that pharmacy has with other PBMs. So some sort of reconciliation and audit has to be done. And certainly I think the state would want to make sure that it is still being applied appropriately. And finally, PBMs pay the CAT tax as well. So this would set the unprecedented, rule of having a double taxing PBMs for the CAT tax. So with that, again, would reiterate our opposition to the bill and happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I don't see a hand right now, but as I advise the others, if you can stay in the room, please do. Thanks. Next is Vince Porter.
Sorry about that, Chair Nathanson. I had to lower my mic. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Vince Porter. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Cambia Health Solutions. And thank you for allowing me the time to voice our concerns with this bill. In the past decade, there's been a robust conversation in both the Senate and House Healthcare Committees over the relationship between insurers, PBMs, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and pharmacies. In 2018, the legislature passed a landmark drug transparency legislation, which was a first step towards shining a light on the reasons why our drug prices are the highest in the world. In 2019, after extensive debate and several collaborative work groups, the legislature passed House Bill 2185, which imposed new requirements on PBMs registered in the state. And it's safe to say that final draft of the law was a product of deep and complicated negotiations. The work continued through the rulemaking process held by DCBS in most of 2020. And again, all sides were given a voice to share their viewpoint on the rules, and we ended up with a formal program that we all now follow this year. With that history in mind, we're deeply concerned that House Bill 2462 has not been given the same amount of work. At the last minute of the first committee deadline in the House Healthcare Committee, the bill was moved from that committee to the House Revenue Committee with no debate on the substantial healthcare policy that is in this bill. We're particularly troubled that Section 5 of this bill was not addressed in the Healthcare Committee, as we feel those new requirements are contrary to the hard work that's been done on this issue over the past few years. And based on several conversations, we were under the impression that Section 5 was going to be removed from the bill before it left the House Healthcare Committee, only to witness a rushed hearing moving the bill to the Revenue Committee. In terms of the policy in Section 5, we do not believe it's appropriate for DCBS to be reviewing our contracts to decide what is or isn't fair. And frankly, with all due respect, I don't believe that they have the staffing or the expertise to weigh in on those contracts. It's plainly an overreach and out of scope for the agency. And giving the agency this vague directive would unquestionably lead to legal disputes in the future. I will make one note that we are very happy with the role that DCBS has taken on relating to drug transparency and believe they've done an excellent job on that effort. Finally, I want to make one quick brief comment to continue with Mr. Head's comments on the tax policy aspect of this bill. In witnessing past tax policy debates, There's been a robust conversation over whether tax is absorbed or can be passed along the supply chain. This bill appears to apply that the taxes like the corporate activities tax does not get passed on and even gives pharmacies permission to pass on their tax responsibilities. I very much appreciate the concerns that have been raised about the role of pharmacies and definitely hear their challenges. But to reiterate, this also would benefit companies like CVS, Walgreens, Rite Aid, even Walmart. And so we would really just question whether that policy decision is the beginning of a slippery slope where others feel entitled to pass on taxes that ultimately land on the consumer. Thank you for the time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. And before I move to the next speaker, I'd like to ask LRO, Ms. Harger, I believe we do have two amendments posted that remove Section 5. Is that correct, that those amendments are posted?
I do believe those amendments are posted, and that, just trying to find which amendments would do that. I believe they are amendments 2 and 4 that include that omission.
Thank you. Next speaker will be Adrian Irwin.
Chair Nathanson, member of the committee. My name is Adrian Irwin, and I am a pharmacist and past president of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I am here today representing the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. Before I provide our comments, I first want to say thank you to the committee for this opportunity, as well as a thank you to Chair Nathanson for her continued engagement and ongoing support in addressing an issue of great concern to the pharmacy community, the impact of the corporate activity tax on the financial viability of community pharmacies. As stated earlier, I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, a collaboration between the two largest professional pharmacy organizations in Oregon, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. As a result, the coalition represents pharmacists across Oregon, as well as those practicing in a variety of areas. Despite this diversity, we are united in our support of House Bill 2462. Community pharmacies have been uniquely impacted by the corporate activity tax. Unlike other settings where the price paid by the consumer is controlled by the business, in community pharmacy, these prices are instead set by pharmacy benefit managers or other third-party payers. Payments are then collected from consumers or patients in our setting in the form of deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurances. These contracts explicitly prohibit additional amounts to be collected, and sample verbiage is provided in our written testimony. As a result, while drug wholesalers and manufacturers can pass along the impact of this tax to the pharmacy by increasing the cost of goods, which is what they are doing, the pharmacy is unable to offset any of these increases. The impact of the corporate activity tax has already been cited as a key driver in the decision for a chain retailer to discontinue pharmacy operations at 13 locations in the Portland metro area, and in the closure of an independently owned community pharmacy. I recognize that the finances surrounding healthcare are complex, and it may be easy for you to view this bill as more appropriate for discussion elsewhere. However, I disagree. This bill is very simple and solely focused on the impact of a tax. It requires that pharmacy benefit managers and other insurers adjust contracts with community pharmacies to account for the revenue impact of a new tax, the corporate activity tax, as here. In some ways, it actually addresses a problem created by insurers' own contract language. As a final closing thought, when the Student Success Act was passed in 2009, it was driven by a commitment to Oregon's future by saying that every child deserved access to high-quality education. Similarly, I would argue that every Oregonian also deserves access to a pharmacy in their own community. Nationally, from 2003 to 2018, approximately 16% of independently owned rural pharmacies closed in the United States, resulting in an estimated 630 rural communities to lose all access to a pharmacy. For a variety of reasons, community pharmacies are in a financially precarious situation. This is complex, and this is a discussion for elsewhere. However, the scope of this bill is in addressing the impact of a single tax. It is not healthcare policy, as the other side might suggest. Will there be some challenges in implementation? Yes. But just like in other bills, these can be addressed in rulemaking and other procedures. On behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, we respectfully request that you support this legislation to require pharmacy benefit managers adjust reimbursement to account for new taxes and help ensure that all Oregonians have access to a community pharmacy. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a question or comment. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I am wondering, for an average independent pharmacy, how much of the line of business comes from pharmacy benefit managers?
In terms of the pharmaceutical sales side of it?
Yeah. How much is it? 40%? Is it 80%? I understand this is a broad generalization.
Yeah, so I mean, the vast majority of claims in a pharmacy are processed through a third-party insurance. So really the only claims that are not impacted or don't go through a PBM in some capacity would be your clients that are accessing or they're paying cash price for a medication, which would be your uninsured population. So depending upon your setting, you could have, some of the federally qualified health centers have upwards of 30% of their patients being uninsured, but that would not be the average community pharmacy, which is probably more in the 5 to 10%. Marie Drugs commented on their payer distribution, and they were saying that only 5% of their clientele would be cash pay, which would be those claims that would not be subject to a PBM contract.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next speaker is Lugina Mendez Harper.
Hi there. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I thank you for that. I got a new computer today, so things are still not working. So good afternoon, Chairwoman Nathanson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dr. Lugina Mendez Harper. I'm a pharmacist with Prime Therapeutics. We are a PBM that's owned in part by Regents of Oregon. And I am appearing before you today to respectfully oppose House Bill 2462. The good news is that I'm not a tax expert, so I too am also coming at this bill with some practical questions and issues that I saw as a pharmacist and a business owner, and then as a representative of the PBM when I read through it. Bill Head from PCMA and Vance Porter touched on some of the things questions I had as far as, what is the scope of these new taxes? Would it be local, state, federal? How would we know what those are? I also had a question about the taxes exceeding the 0.3% of total drug sales. One of the questions that I had was why it was total drug costs versus those costs or those transactions that go through a PBM. There was a pharmacist that said, they weren't willing to increase the prices for the uninsured, for people who are paying the cash price to cover CAT. But what this bill is doing is asking employers, insurers, and insured Oregonians to take on that burden. So just want to make certain that is something that's clear. From a previous business owner perspective, this legislation also says that 0.3% threshold is for the entire term of the contract, which is a little unusual to me. Generally, from a tax perspective, you're looking at annual or quarterly tax periods. So I wanted to just point that out. More importantly, there's some conflicts in the legislation that kind of put us as a PBM in a weird situation, because one of the things that the legislation is drafted requires is for us to amend our contracts with pharmacies or adjust their reimbursement or refund them some of these additional costs. But then when you look into the section of the legislation that talks about retaliation, it states that amending contracts could be considered retaliation by a PBM. So certainly wanted to point out those conflicting provisions that may cause some questions for us, which leads into, you know, there are some other examples of retaliation in the bill that are things that we do as a normal course of our business. So we may ask for recoupments or ask for additional money. If we do an audit and we've noted that overpayment has occurred and we've gone through the whole audit and appeal process that is available to pharmacies, so that's a normal course of business. But one of the things that really concerned me was the legislation doesn't allow us to cancel a contract with a pharmacy for at least 5 years, and we have to give them 10 months of notice before we do that. And that was really concerning to me from a fraud, waste, and abuse perspective. I looked really quickly, and in March of last year, the Department of Justice indicted an owner of two Portland-based compounding pharmacies that billed just one PBM over $3.4 million in potentially fraudulent claims in 1 year. And it was after that PBM had paid up $1.69 million to that pharmacy that the fraud was detected. So if this legislation passes as written, we would not be able to take action and would have to provide that pharmacy 10 months of notice before we were able to do anything, which is essentially the same time frame that $3.4 million worth of fraud occurred. So these are just some of the things that from a policy perspective, we really want to ensure that there's some additional dialogue and thought process that goes into this. And why we would ask for some additional work and engagement on this. So for those reasons, that is why I stand in opposition and certainly willing to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. I don't see a hand right now, but as we've asked the others, please stay in the room just in case. Thank you. Next. And the last speaker is Nikki Terzieff.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. As Ms. Irwin stated earlier, we're a coalition made up of both kind of your Main Street pharmacists and your hospital and health system pharmacists. We're here in support today of this bill, and we're here in support today of the Dash 4, which will answer a couple of questions from the folks who have come before me. One is the removal of Section 5. We support that. That is a policy discussion that we agree and honor, you know, should occur in a healthcare policy committee, perhaps. But there are some other pieces of this bill that we believe belong here. This is a question of revenue. This is a question of business health. These Main Street pharmacists whom you've heard from today are pharmacists that are serving communities out in the rural areas as well as in the urban areas. The urban areas deserve, I would argue, just as much access and just as much ease of access to medication as those in the rural areas. You've heard a couple of different questions today. I want to thank Mr. Head and for laying out the idea that, you know, PBMs, it wouldn't just be contracting with one PBM. Pharmacists and pharmacies are forced into contracting with PBMs because they own so much of the market share. Insurers contract with them. The role they play is a reasonable role. It's an administrative role, and it's kind of eventually grown and morphed and grown and been largely unexamined. And the only impact really that those relationships have here is that the pharmacists stand at the end of the line. And in between the patient who's at the window, who's got an insurance card and a copay that is inflexible and does not change, and the pharmacist who is attempting to give them their medication. That transaction, you know, I think you heard it early on, there's not enough handcrafted soap in the world that's going to be able to cover those costs. And so we're supportive of this notion. I'm interested in having further conversation. I appreciate the concerns about what tax specifically we're speaking of. I believe we're speaking of state taxes. And so in light of both some of the concerns and questions that have been raised around enforcement, it's certainly a question that perhaps DCBS may be able to answer, you know, Madam Chair, that's your prerogative to kind of call them in or poke around on that. But I do think that they have a responsibility and an insight into that relationship, that contractual relationship, just out of the nature of the work they do at that agency, and is going to be one way that we can start to examine those pieces. I think that I've captured most of my notes. We're very pleased and very grateful to be able to have this conversation with you all today, being able to have access to care and access to medicine and even the services that pharmacies offer in the main street setting. Clinical pharmacy services are very important to the health of our overall constituencies in the state of Oregon. So thank you, and I will pause there and also be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your comments. That's the end of the list. And Manny, I'm just confirming with you that we have gone through the list of people who have requested to speak.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee members, are there any other questions for these witnesses? Okay. Mr. Alanak or Ms. Harger, any comments from you before I close the public hearing on this bill?
None for me, Madam Chair, but I'm not sure if Chris wants to add anything.
Okay.
I don't have anything either, Madam Chair.
Okay. I don't see any other hands. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2462. Thank you all for being present. And remember that you do have 24 hours from the start of today's meeting to submit written testimony if you like. Next, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 3143.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. This is Jamie McGovern for the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3143 would adjust the interest computation on delinquent property taxes to daily rather than monthly. And that adjustment would reflect essentially an equivalent amount just calculated daily rather than monthly than what's currently in statute. And yeah, we have heard this in a public hearing on March 18th, and there were discussions about how that would be administered and the effect that the current monthly calculation has on delinquent property taxpayers and the impact, the additional impact of the pandemic on these issues. And yeah, that's what I have.
Thank you. Committee members, this is committee time to discuss the bill, to just kick around the ideas, ask questions. Waiting to see hands for discussion. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, just trying to recall this bill during the public hearing. If I recall, it seemed like a simple thing to do, and then there was somebody from the county assessor's office, I believe it was, who said it would be an expensive change for them to make. And then I think Mr. Smith, Representative Smith, chimed in and said he could do it on his calculator. So that's my recollection of the bill. I don't know if LRO has any more information as far as what the cost to assessors would be to implement this change.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, you're correct. There was a discussion from the county assessors on the administrative approaches and logistics that would be required for daily calculation. We still don't have complete information for that from the counties. And also, I would say that is affected by the fact that the counties all function sort of in sync, but also separately. And just to add to that, I'm sure that all the members recall or aware of, but I did add a little bit of language about the way in the background part of the SMS about the way that the tax payments are currently due, the one-third, and one-third, and then when it becomes late. And then, of course, the delinquent payments. And then eventually after 3 years, the potential for foreclosure. And then I thought I would add, well, I can leave it there. Or sorry, Refreshki. But yes, we're still working through those numbers. We have a little bit more information, but just moving along.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up comment.
Yes, sure.
For me, that's kind of the not the deal breaker, but that's going to be how I land on this. And so it's going to be exorbitantly expensive for counties. I'm probably going to say no, but if it's something that we find is reasonable and easy, I'll probably be a yes. So that is information that I need to have to make a good decision. Thank you.
Rep Reschke, earlier this afternoon, there was an email message sent by Eric Kanzler to, it looks like it went to all the members of the committee, plus a few people in Department of Revenue and LRO. And it mentions another approach, a variation of this related to when interest would start accruing. It's a different way to provide some relief in the situation. So I think it would be helpful to us all to be able to review that email message when there's an opportunity. I wouldn't expect everyone to have had a chance to see it yet because it did come in just this afternoon. And I want to point out that even after that, not going to everyone, I received another communication that indicates that it's possible League of Oregon Cities has determined that the proposal wouldn't create any revenue loss concerns for cities. Now, that comment was about cities, not counties, but that would be cities generally, you know, throughout Oregon, small, large, medium. So I think we do have some more maybe options and information to share and to put on the record. Representative Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson. I was curious if the computation was prorated, how that could impact cost, given that it's currently calculated on a monthly basis. If you can share a little bit more about whether that would be a significant change or not.
I think that's for LRO or a Department of Revenue person to respond to.
Representative Valderrama, thank you, Chair Nathanson. Representative Valderrama, I was just wondering if you could either restate or clarify. I'm having a little trouble with my connection, and I'm wondering if when you're asking about the daily computation versus the monthly computation and the costs or the revenues, you're discussing or you're asking about the cost of administering that to the local government, or you're asking about how much they would collect differently. Or both.
Yes, thank you for the clarification. It's the former. So really the cost to administer.
Thank you, Representative Valderrama. So yeah, I think that Chair Nathanson mentioned that, and Representative Reschke mentioned that there is sort of work, we're kind of doing ongoing research into what these complications that the counties brought up would be during, for daily computations. And we don't have set numbers on that yet. And then, you know, currently, so the local governments and their property tax collections and their delinquent fees are set up in a system, and that system is evidently set up programmatically to calculate these amounts monthly, and then, you know, essentially go out and get those monies from delinquent payers. And I'll say that sort of annually, that money equates to about $33 million in just, you know, in the fees for delinquent property taxpayers. So that's the money that's coming in from these delinquent fees. And then the statement, as far as I understand it from the email that came around, was that, you know, in the conversation of the public hearing, was that if you assess a monthly fee on someone who's delinquent for only 2 days, then, you know, this bill would propose to essentially charge only 2 days of delinquent fees and interest. And then I think the proposal or the alternative version in the email was something like, well, in order to not charge people delinquency fees for more than they have actually been late, but also to reduce the administrative costs, what if there was just the first month of delinquency was waived? Something of to this effect, which would keep the monthly system, but push it back a month instead of having this daily computation, which we don't quite understand why or how costly that would be. But that is the comments that we've heard, and we're still working through that.
And there's one other thing that occurs to me in something that I heard or read. It became a little more clear to me that for some local jurisdictions, the concern wasn't necessarily that it was difficult to do, but it was timing. Could they get to it quickly enough? How long would it take them to actually accomplish this? So one thing I would wonder is, should the bill, if the committee is interested in it, allow a little more time before this went into effect, to allow the time for the assessors or the local jurisdictions to figure out the administrative nuts and bolts, software or administrative processing and so forth. So that's just another thing to provide a little more leeway toward the local jurisdictions' concerns. Looks like there's a lot more that ought to be explored here. We can certainly raise these issues with the bill's author. Any other questions or comments? This was another good opportunity to explore an idea, to dig into it a little bit. LRO, any comments from you before I close this work session?
Chair Nathanson, we'll just continue to work on this so that we can inform the members.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And the thing I would add, and maybe I misunderstood some of the questions here, is you have a monthly calculation versus a daily calculation. But I don't know if you can stick with the monthly calculation and then just prorate it for the number of days. It seems like there might be a third path here that might have been suggested, if I'm understanding some of the comments from today. So there's not that programming to do the daily calculation, but you can still adjust for the 2 days or 3 days by a final calculation at the end. And that might have been what Rep. Smith was getting at last time. And I think that might have been part of Rep. Valderrama's question today, if I followed that question correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Allenack, for making that really clear for us. Anything else from anyone? Yes, Rep. Valderrama.
Yes, thank you for thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to clarify that. That I would just reiterate that that was my question, just to see if the concern really was administrative cost, if we are then prorating based on the costs that are already established on a monthly basis, if that actually decreases the administrative burden, if that's something that's already occurring, or if it's still, you know, produces the same concerns that folks have already shared. But again, I don't know what those concerns are. And it sounds like from the response that there's not enough information yet to know. So just appreciate the clarification.
I don't see any other hands. And we've had some follow-up from LRO. I think that does it for this bill for today. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 3143. Mr. Allenack, is there any business before us before we adjourn today?
No, Madam Chair, you've completed your agenda.
Okay. Thanks all. See you tomorrow. We're adjourned.